Session number 7038, Reel 2.
General Fox Pitt, Reel 2. General, I think you were mentioning that the 8 2-pounder anti-tank guns were not part of your brigade.
No, they were posted to me for this particular operation, and I'd never seen them before. And they were sent in a separate destroyer to join me at Boulogne.
When did you know they were going to join you?
I imagine before we started, but I can't remember now.
And these were Royal Artillery?
Royal Artillery, yeah.
How was the journey across the Channel? Did anything happen on the passage?
No, perfectly, very calm sea, and nothing happened.
What time did you arrive at Boulogne?
Well, I went ahead in Whitchat destroyer and reported to General Brownrigg, who had established his headquarters at Wimereux.
And what time do you think you got
there?
We
reported to him at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he briefly explained the situation was as follows. The enemy, one MT column, had been reported at Etaples. Enemy FVs were also reported the area Cressy Forest. Our own troops, the 21st French Division, was stated to be holding a position of Neuve-Châtel, Seymour and Werwinges. Each of these were said to be held by approximately one battalion. Her intention was to prolong this line as far as Devray. For this purpose, the remainder of the day, the remainder of the division, were to be moved up from the east by train. British troops in Boulogne were situated as follows. Roadblocks by a few RE or AA personnel were sighted on four main roads running southeast and south from Boulogne. These roadblocks were sighted 8 to 9 miles out from Boulogne. Over 1,500 personnel of the ANPC were in Boulogne but had not taken up any tactical positions and were of no military value, as the officers and the NCOs had no control over them. It was found impossible to form them into a fighting force. Wimereux was lightly guarded by personnel from A Branch GHQ. The Fort de la Grèche was held by AA personnel. General Brownrigg stated that one battalion of tanks and one battalion of the Queen Victoria Rifles were to be landed that night at Calais and could be expected early the following morning. His instructions were that Boulogne was to be held. Only 5 1-inch maps of Boulogne were obtainable for the whole brigade, and a few small scale. The brigadier, and the brigade major then returned to Boulogne, where the battalion were disembarking. Commanding officers were sent for, allotted provisional sectors from the map. A forward RV were arranged for battalions, and the brigadier left for reconnaissance with the officer commanding 2nd Battalion Irish Guards and the officer commanding anti-tank battery.
So after you'd been up to General Brownrigg, you then went back into Boulogne, where the troops were coming ashore.
Yeah.
And you did a reconnaissance first by map and then followed that up by actually looking at the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you actually get up to Wimmera from Boulogne?
Oh, I took some car that I found on the quay, and Brigade Major and I drove it. As far as I remember, it only had one gear forward, which worked, but it did work. But there were an awful lot of things lying about, and we took the one that we thought would work best.
When you got into Boulogne, what was your first impression of the town?
Well, the town was in perfectly good order. It hadn't been bombed much. The quay was absolutely chock-a-block with personnel who had filtered down from the battlefront. I met one young officer in the Grenadiers who'd been on some sniper course, and he was ordered home to England. And he was one of... there were also two horses there belonging to the Duke of Gloucester, which supposed to be embarked for England. There were a mass of pioneer corps people, absolutely out of control, with no officer or NCOs taking much interest in them, just trying to get off to go back to England.
So they were in a state of panic, were they?
Not at all. But they were just milling round, trying to find some ship to get onto, you know. And I pointed out later that it would be far better to get rid of them if we could, which they in fact did get rid of most of them.
Now, you say they had no military value.
No, not much. They had rifles. But they just, some of them I found just shooting off into the town where it were occupied by our own troops, so you couldn't rely on them to be much value.
But they presumably hadn't been trained as soldiers.
No, they were sent out there to dig trenches and that sort of thing.
So basically labourers.
They were bare labour, yeah.
Were there officers trying to get a grip of them?
Oh, yes, some of them. But there were very few officers, and they, again, were not very military-minded sort of officers.
When you went up to Wimmera to meet General Brownrigg, what was the atmosphere at the rear GHQ like?
Well, there was very little of it, but they were completely vague, rarely, as to what was out in front. And the information I've just given you turned out to be quite inaccurate. And all they did know was that the Germans were on the way, and that was what they didn't know how close they were. And General Brownrigg told me at the time he was then going to move his headquarters down into Boulogne. In fact, he did, but he also departed that night for England. And so by the next morning, I was alone in command of the whole thing.
Were the headquarters staff basically optimistic or pessimistic in their outlook?
I don't think they really knew what was happening at all. I think they were told. I mean, they knew there was a general evacuation from France, and they were told that they'd got to get back to England. This really was the chief thing. And the 20th Guards Brigade was to hold Boulogne until everything was got out.
When you had your conference with battalion commanders in Boulogne, how long did that planning conference take?
Oh, very short. One of the few maps we'd got, I selected on the ground where the battalion should go. Roughly speaking, one battalion south of the river that runs out of Boulogne, and one battalion to the north, perhaps 3 or 4 miles outside Boulogne. General Browning had wanted me to hold a front much further out, but with two battalions, that was absolutely impossible, and so I decided on my own to hold a nearer line, which was quite a good defensive position on the hills outside Boulogne. But my conference with the commanding officers at the quay was not very long, because I went off to do my own reconnaissance with my brigade major, and taking the commanding officer of the Irish Guards with me, but leaving the commanding officer of the Welsh Guards to meet me at another place, which we eventually did.
How did you conduct this reconnaissance on the ground? Was that by motor vehicle?
Well, as far as we could, and by foot, and by looking. We couldn't naturally cover every yard of the front, but we went to certain positions and had a look at it. But we were very, very thin on the ground. We had to hold what we could.
What sort of criteria did you use when selecting a defensive position?
My own criteria that one knows about defensive positions I used, and we selected positions with a good field of fire, because we realised our enemy had tanks and anti-tank guns, and so we got ourselves out of Boulogne onto the hills round it, so to speak, where we could see a certain distance in all directions. That was what I went for.
So it's basically high ground.
Yes, the outside Boulogne, the ground is fairly high outside the town, very quickly, and we went as far as we thought necessary out there without spreading ourselves out too much.
Were you counting upon the reinforcement that had been promised you?
Well, I had thought that these people were coming from Calais, from what I was told, because as it turned out, they never appeared.
How would you have deployed them if they had arrived?
What I think I should have done, I was supposed to have a tank battalion and one territorial battalion, you see. I think I should have employed the territorial battalion on the left flank between the Welsh Guards and the sea, because they didn't cover the whole of that front. I should have divided the tank companies up between the two battalions, I think, in an anti-tank role.
So they would have been local support for the infantry.
That's it, yeah. They would have been very useful.
How long did it take the infantry companies to get up from the quay and into their forming up areas?
After I'd done my reconnaissance, I went back down the whole line, and by then the companies were arriving, except for the two companies were in the ship by themselves, who had to be brought on later. They didn't take... They marched out of their position. And I think the commanding officers managed to pinch cars to get out and do their reconnaissance. And we pinched any vehicle we find. But there were an awful lot of refugees on the road, and it was very difficult to get along. And I remember that particularly myself. Getting a car along the road was extremely difficult.
Presumably the refugees were in fairly bad condition.
Yes. Well, they were about the end of their gasp, and in a suddenly strange way, they all disappeared. I think they moved off down the coast, down towards Latuke, that direction. Well, they never cluttered up the port.
Did you have a guard on the port to keep them away?
No, not knowingly. There were a certain number of civilians trying to get on our destroyers at the end.
What about French troops? Were there many of them in the town?
Very few French troops actually materialised. The instructions I've been given about the division in front of me, those troops never came near Boulogne, and we saw the general and his staff officer, and he said that his whole brigade had been plié, as he described it, which meant packed up. I think half of them were caught on the train by the Germans and taken prisoner. But he had no troops at all. And there were a few young soldiers in the citadel at Boulogne, but we got packed them off down to the south, and because they were no military value. It was a sort of depot.
So they were recruits in for training?
Yes, that sort of thing. When we really saw very little of the French. And the general himself and his staff officer decided he wanted to, he would try and get out down south, and I never saw him again.
What about the civil population of Boulogne?
There were a lot about, but they weren't very, very obvious. They sort of got into their houses and kept in their houses while the battle was going on. We thought a certain number of fifth columnists about were sniping us and that sort of thing, but they were probably infiltrated Germans. We don't know then.
You didn't catch any of the snipers?
Yes. No, they did. Yes, they did catch some. I think it comes in my report later on. Mm-hmm.
But you had? Did you have any contact with the civil authorities in Boulogne? The mayor?
No contact with the authorities at all. No.
What time do you think it was before you'd actually finished your reconnaissance of the line you're going to hold?
I don't know. By the time I'd finished my reconnaissance, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, I should think. By the time the commanding officers had finished their reconnaissance and the troops were beginning to move up, it must have been 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
When the battalion commanders were actually sorting out their own deployments, how did they do it? Did they give discretion to company commanders within a certain area?
I'm not sure exactly how they did, but I think they did. They went and allotted areas to their company commanders. They did it pretty thoroughly, and so they knew exactly where their company's area was and went round with the company commanders and told them what position they had to hold. The only people who were rather in the air were the Welsh Guards, who had a company with nothing on their left between them and the sea, quite a long way.
So they had an open
3 or 4
flank.
Miles. Huh?
They had an open flank, an open flank.
But we didn't know then. We thought that was the way that the troops from Calais were coming, you see.
What about the anti-tank weapons?
I allotted them to battalions. And there were 8 guns. I allotted 4 to each battalion. And then they had their own anti-tank platoons as well, which were a less effective little gun, I think.
And what about the anti-aircraft troops?
We had no anti-aircraft of our own. And when we arrived, there were some anti-aircraft balloons flying, but they very mysteriously got let off and the personnel disappeared when things get a bit hot.
So you had no control over anti-aircraft?
No. We had no anti-tank ground guns at all.
When the troops had arrived in their positions, what happened next? Were they then told to dig in?
They were digging. They dug in as hard as they could for the whole of that afternoon and evening.
Was there any sign of the enemy?
And all the night. They weren't any of them attacked till the next morning. early next morning.
So you had reasonably prepared positions.
Yes, I think we did, but some companies dug much better than others.
What sort of field works did they, or positions did they dig? What sort of...
Well, they were what I call platoon areas, which they've been taught to dig, you know, sort of a little... I forget what you used to describe them, sort of a platoon area with sections in each section trenches and communications of the platoon commander and then so on.
But they didn't dig a continuous line of entrenchment.
No, they couldn't possibly do that, you see.
Did each platoon have a redoubt or anything of that sort?
No, I don't think so, no.
You say they had...
No, they only had what trenches they could dig. Mm.
They had section trenches. Does this mean that you would have 10 or 12 men in a single trench?
Yes, that's roughly. I don't know what the section strength was. I don't think it was as much as 10, then. I don't know. No.
But how many sections would there be in a platoon? Would there be three or...?
Four sections in a platoon. And they're each supposed to have a Bren gun. Yeah, the Irish Guards are a bit short of equipment.
Were the sections deployed in lines, or were they staggered or in depth? What sort of pattern did the trenches...
Well, they were sort of blobs, you know. They weren't in one straight line, but they were all self-supporting and supporting each other, you see.
With overlapping arcs.
Yeah.
Roughly, what distance would there be between one section and the next?
Oh, perhaps 50 to 100 yards, not much more than that.
So you'd have a little blob with
about
8 or 9 men in it with a Bren gun and some rifles, and then another little blob about 100 yards away, and they would cover the ground between them.
Yes, that's right. We had no wire or anything like that we could use.
What was the soil like on these positions?
The soil was fairly light. When you get up on the hill there, it's rather sort of sandy soil. It's quite easy to dig.
Similar to the soil at Cambly?
Yes, more or less, yes. Yeah.
So they could dig fairly deep, could they?
Yes. I think they did dig in fairly deep in the time, from what I remember. When I went round the next morning, I saw quite a number of the places were dug in.
Could they do anything to conceal or camouflage the positions they had?
Well, within reason, I suppose they could, but they'd hardly completed digging by the time they were attacked the next morning, you see.
Did you reconnoitre positions for use in the event of a withdrawal when you did your...
Not at that time, no.
What about the local security of the troops when they were digging? Did they have patrols out during the night, for instance?
They had covering parties out, yes. Yeah. But it was all a bit confusing because we'd been told that there were a certain number of our own troops still out in front, you see. In fact, they never materialised them, so frankly, no British troops withdrew from our line at all.
Did you have any trouble with refugees or other stray people wandering around?
Well, the odd ones, but most of them had sort of come through or disappeared by the time my brigade had dug in.
What sort of positions did you have for the anti-tank weapons?
Again, they were dug in according to what they were supposed to dug in, but very badly, most of them. They were not very well trained. And particularly the gunner ones had not really been shown how to dig their anti-tank guns in at all. They'd done very little training.
Were they massed in groups, or were they dug in?
Well, they were allotted to the battalion commanders, and they were placed in certain positions. I remember in one, in the case of the Welsh Guards, they were firing straight down a road, which was quite a suitable position. But they were eventually mopped up.
But were they generally right in the front line, or were they a bit behind?
Yes, more than they were generally pretty well up in the front.
And were they generally on their own, or did they have infantry immediately
around
them?
Well, they had infantry around them, yeah. Mm.
What sort of range were they supposed to have, these weapons?
Well, the two-pounder hasn't got a very, very big, powerful range. I mean, they took on the tanks when they did come at a range of about 300 or 400 yards, but I should think that is about the maximum that they would be any have any effect on the thing.
What about the effective range for rifle fire and the Bren guns? What sort of range would the troops?
Well, I mean, that's the same as we are now. I mean, you don't generally take on infantry targets more than about 300 or 400 yards in front of you if you can avoid it. Wait till they get a bit closer.
So you've got them dug in a fairly effective line of platoon positions all the way around the town. What sort of arrangements could you make for administration, for supply of food, water?
Well, the battalions had their headquarters, and there was a certain amount of massive rations lying about everywhere. They had plenty of supplies which we could, but we really hardly had time to organise any proper supply with our. But my RASC officer was did his best to collect the supplies in certain places and tell battalions where they could get them from. You see.
So he formed a sort of central dump, and then the battalion
down on the quay, really.
Presumably they requisitioned anything that was useful to them.
Yeah.
Did men manage to get themselves fed and to sleep at all?
Very little. By the time we eventually evacuated, they were very tired. They'd been digging all night, more or less, and then in the early morning they began to be attacked, and then later on they had to withdraw. So none of the troops had very much sleep.
What about food?
What?
What about food? Were they able to cook food? To eat? Food?
Oh, food. Well, they got plenty of food. They had an iron ration with them, you know, and they never seemed to be short of anything to eat.
Do you think that they used food as a substitute for sleep?
I don't know.